مارك السهابة The Voice of أهل السنة والجماعة.
إن شاء الله مولانا جزاك الله for your grace and giving me the leeway to continue. الحمد لله with the grace and mercy of Allah سبحانه وتعالى. We present our program بلاد المسلمين this morning and through some research I have come across a very very interesting piece of opinion from Ahmad Najjar, a Palestinian political analyst and playwright. In Al Jazeera, he has written that Israel kills lies and the Western media believe it. The execution of 15 Gaza medics and rescuers demonstrates just how normalized the dehumanization of Palestinians is. 15 members of the Palestinian Red Crescent Society and civil defense were killed. Not fighters, not militants, not people hiding rockets or weapons and weapons. They were aid workers, humanitarians, medics who ran towards the injured when bombs fell, people who gave their lives trying to save others. On March 23rd in Rafah in southern Gaza, Israeli forces targeted a convoy of ambulances and emergency vehicles. 8 Red Crescent staff, 6 from the Palestinian Civil Defense, and 1 United Nations staff member were slaughtered. Israeli military claimed the vehicles were unmarked and suspected of carrying militants. But that was a lie. Footage retrieved from the phone of Rifat Radwan, one of the murdered medics, shows flashing red lines, clearly marked vehicles, and no weapons inside. Then heavy Israeli gunfire. Rifat's body was later found in a mass grave along with 13 others, some of which bore the signs of execution, bullets in the head or chest and hands bound. Even in death, they had to prove they were aid workers. And still much of the Western media reported Israel's version first. And this is in inverted commas. Israel says the IDF states, a military source tells, these carefully worded lines carry more weight than the bloodstained uniforms of the Red Crescent, more than the evidence, more than the truth. This is not new. This is not an isolated mistake. This is a system in which Palestinians are presumed guilty, a system in which hospitals must prove they are hospitals, schools must prove they are schools, and children must prove they are not human shields. A system in which our existence is treated as a threat, one that must be justified, explained, verified, before anyone will mourn us. This is what your dehumanization looks like. The author says that he was born and raised in Gaza. He knows what the Red Crescent vest means. It means hope when there's nothing left. It means someone is coming to help, not to fight, not to kill, but to save. It means that even in the middle of the rubble and death, life still matters to someone. And he says he also knows what it means to lose that. To see medics killed and then smeared. To hear the world debate their innocence while their colleagues dig through mass graves. To watch the people who tried to save life reduced to statistics, framed as suspects, and then forgotten. Dehumanization is not just a rhetorical problem. It is not just media framing or political language. It kills, it erases, it allows the world to look away while entire communities are wiped out. It tells us Your life does not matter the same way. Your grief is not real until we verify it. Your death is not tragic until we prove it. This is the Western world. This is why the deaths of these 15 medics and rescuers matter so deeply. Because their story is not just about one atrocity. It is about the machinery of doubt that kicks in every time Palestinians are killed. It is about how we become our own forensic investigators, our own legal team, our own public relations firm, while mourning the dead. This burden is not placed on anyone else. When Western journalists are killed, they are honored. When Israeli civilians die, their names and faces fill screens around the world. When Palestinians die, their families have to prove they weren't terrorists first. We are always guilty until proven innocent, and often not even then. Study after study has shown, and has found also, that Western media quote Israeli sources far more than Palestinian ones, and fail to challenge Israeli statements with the same rigor. Palestinian voices are not only marginalized, but are also often framed as unreliable or emotional, as if grief discredits truth, as if pain makes us irrational. This media pattern fuels and reflects political divisions. From arms sales to diplomatic immunity, from silence at international forums to vetoes at the UN, it is all connected. When Palestinians are not seen as fully human, then the killers are not seen as fully responsible. And the emotional toll is immense. We do not just grieve, we defend our grief. We do not just bury our dead. We fight to have their deaths recognized. We lived with the psychological pressure no community should bear. The pressure to prove we are not what the world has already decided what we are. These 15 medics and 15 responders were heroes. They ran towards danger. They served their people. They believed in the sanctity of life, in a place where their life is constantly under siege. Their memory should be sacred. Instead, their story became another battleground. The world needs to stop making us prove we are human. Stop assuming that we lie and that our killers tell the truth. Stop accepting a narrative that requires Palestinians to be saints in order to be mourned. These medics deserve to be believed. They deserve to be protected, and they deserve justice. But most of all, they deserve, as we all do, to be seen as humans. This is the tragedy that is unfolding in the Middle East, especially in the Palestinian territories, the West Bank, and the Gaza. The level at which they treat the Palestinians is just dehumanizing. And Allah Ta'ala make it easy for the Palestinian people, because what they are going through now is no human being can ever accept the atrocities that are being perpetrated by the Zionist regime. Allah made it easy for the Palestinians. Well, now we return back to our program on Pakistan. And after the 1857 massacres, the establishment of the Congress and the Muslim League, the British, who were in control, the imperial power that was in control of India, decided to grant independence to the Indians. And in the atmosphere of creating a Muslim country, There was a lot of negotiations taking place. The Constituent Assembly and Attlee Statement of 1947, elections to the Constituent Assembly had taken place in 1946. And the Constituent Assembly met for the first time in Delhi in December of 1946. Out of the 296 members, Congress and its allies secured 212 seats, and the Muslim League 73 seats. The Muslim League refused to participate in its deliberations. Jinnah and Nehru were invited to London when attempt was made to reconcile conflicting interpretations of the Muslims' plan and to induce the League to take part in the proceedings of the Assembly. Meanwhile, Congress was proceeding with constitution making in the absence of the League. And in January 1947, the objectives resolution was passed. On the first, no, it is the 31st of January 1947. The Muslim League passed a resolution protesting that the Congress, instead of postponing the sittings of the Assembly until fundamental points of principle had been settled, had not only acted on its own interpretation of the cabinet mission, but had forced decisions on the Assembly which were clearly outside the scope of the plan. The objective resolution passed by the Constituent Assembly on 22nd January had proclaimed an independent federal republic. Rules of procedure had been made in violation of the direction in the plan, which envisaged that the central constitution was not to be considered until the provincial and regional group constitutions had been settled. The League therefore called upon the British government to declare that plan had failed. On the 20th of February 1947, Clement Attlee, the British Prime Minister, made an important declaration. He announced that the British government would grant full self-government to British India by June 1948, at the latest. In the meantime, according to the statement, preparatory measures would be put in hand in advance and legislation would be introduced in due course to give effect to the final transfer of power. The British government would negotiate an agreement regarding matters arising out of the transfer of power with representatives of those whom they proposed to transfer power. The future of the princely states had to wait until the date of the final transfer of power. It was also announced that Lord Mountbatten was to succeed Lord Wavell as the Viceroy of India, who would be entrusted with the task of transferring power into Indian hands. Lord Mountbatten reached New Delhi on the 24th of March 1947 and declared that he would complete the work of transfer of power into Indian hands within the next few months in consultation with Indian leaders. On his arrival, he was faced with a desperate situation. The central cabinet was so divided as to be almost impotent. In the Punjab, the unionist government was tottering under the attack of the Muslim League. And in the northwest frontier, there was a Muslim League civil disobedience campaign. All over the country, fierce communal clashes were taking place and private armies were being formed for the final struggle for power. The civil services were bitterly divided on communal lines. and headed by dispirited Englishmen anxious to retire. British troops were already being repatriated, and the morale of the Indian Army was uncertain. It was evident that the unity of India could not be maintained. Mountbatten started a new series of conferences and talks with the Congress, the Muslim League, and the Sikh leaders. He tried to persuade Jinnah to join the Constituent Assembly, but without success. After all, Jinnah understood the consequences, because it would have meant submission and capitulation to brute majority, as the League was outnumbered by the Congress by 73-199. Mountbatten later claimed that he had worked hand in glove with Indian leaders at every step of development of the new plan. But this claim is not substantiated from the writings of the number of British authors who had access to the inner story of the transfer of power. It is now quite clear that his final draft for the transfer of power was prepared in consultation with Mountbatten's Hindu constitutional advisor, V.P. Menon, and that this draft had been shown only to Nehru, and Jinnah was ignored completely. The Muslim League and its leaders were not taken into confidence at the time of making of the final draft. On 3rd June 1947, the British government accepted the principle of the partition of India and undertook to hand over dominion status to the successive governments on the 15th August, with the implicit right to secede from the Commonwealth. The Mountbatten plan of 3rd June 1947 did not elaborate any constitutional proposals. It outlined the procedure to ascertain the wishes of the people of those areas in which the majority of the representatives boycotted the Constituent Assembly, and whether the constitution should be framed by the existing assembly or by a new and separate assembly. In other words, to determine whether they wished to join Pakistan or not. In Bengal, the Punjab, and Sindh, the choice was left to the members of the provincial legislative assemblies. But the assemblies in Bengal and Punjab would each meet in two parts, one representing the Muslim majority districts and the other the Hindu majority districts. Each part would vote separately on the questions whether or not the province should be partitioned, and if so, which constituent assembly the areas it represented should join. But there was also a provision that if any member of the legislative assembly so demanded, a vote of the whole should be taken if the two parts decided to remain united. If in either part of the legislative assembly the verdict went in favor of partition, the province would be provisionally divided on the basis of Muslim majority and non-Muslim districts. Thereafter, a boundary commission would demarcate the boundaries of the two parts of the province on the basis of contiguous majority areas of Muslim and non-Muslim. The Northwest Frontier Province presented a problem. Though it was a Muslim-majority province, it still had a Congress ministry in power. The responsibility of making the crucial decision of joining India or Pakistan could not fairly be entrusted to the provincial assembly, in which Hindu and Sikh minorities, though counting only 8% of the population, had been given no less than 12 seats out of a total of 50. It was therefore necessary to give the province an opportunity to decide whether it wished to form a part of Pakistan. Hence, the plan provided the Viceroy, in consultation with the provincial government, should arrange for the referendum of the electors of the Chosen Assembly. If decisions in Bengal should go in favor of partition, a similar referendum would be held in Muslim-majority districts of Salat in Assam province. Special administrative arrangements were made to determine the wishes of the people of Baluchistan. The new plan concluded with an announcement which promised to make the transfer of power much simpler and even earlier than June 1948. The decision was to introduce legislation during the current session of the British Parliament for the transfer of power in 1947 on a dominion status basis to either one of the two successive authorities, according to the decision taken under the plan. This would be without prejudice to the right of the Constituent Assembly to decide in due course whether India or Pakistan should remain within the Commonwealth. Soon became known on August 15, 1947, was the date on which the British would hand over power. Both the Congress and the Muslim League accepted the plan. The Muslim majority parts of India decided to in favor of Pakistan. By the end of June, the procedure for deciding on the unity or partition of Bengal and Punjab had been worked out. In each case, it had resulted in a verdict in favor of partition. The Sindh Assembly registered its decision on the 26th June. The referendum in the Northwest Province and in the district of Salat similarly resulted in favor of Pakistan. In Punjab, Khizr Raya Tiwana, who headed the Unionist Ministry, resigned, making way for the Nawab of Mamdot, leader of the Muslim League in Punjab, to form the government. It may be pointed out here that the partitioning of Bengal and Punjab was a painful act. The percentage of Muslim population in Bengal was 55 and in Punjab 57. Both the provinces ought to have joined Pakistan as a whole. Perhaps the vagueness of the Lahore resolution led to the partitioning of these provinces. Reportedly, Mountbatten pointed out to League leaders that the area of Pakistan, as when envisaged in the Lahore resolution, did not include the entire provinces of Punjab, Bengal, and Assam, because the Lahore resolution carefully used the phrase areas in which the Muslims are numerically in a majority, as in the northwestern and eastern zones of India. If the framers of the Lahore resolution had been clear and confident about Muslim majority in the entire provinces of Punjab, Bengal, and Assam, they would have been more specific. Accordingly, Mountbatten argued, the Muslim League could not oppose the partition of these provinces, as this was clearly hinted at by the Lahore resolution, which used the term areas without clearly defining what provinces the term areas constituted. The increasing tempo which marked the new plan as compared to the cabinet mission plan was further accelerated by the Indian Independence Bill. Within 1 month, the bill was drafted, referred to the Viceroy, and discussed by him with the Congress and League leaders, so that on 4th July it was introduced to the British Parliament. On the 18th of July, only 14 days after its introduction, the bill received the royal assent. On the day after Indian Independence Act was passed, the legal birth of a new dominions was marked by the splitting of the interim government in New Delhi into two groups representing the two successor governments, India and Pakistan. Lord Mountbatten went to Karachi to formally inaugurate the new state of Pakistan in August 1947, on the 14th of August. Well, now we have come to the end of our program. We trust that you and the listeners will have a wonderful day today. To you and the listeners of Makkah Sahaba, the voice of the Ahlus Sunnah wal Jamaah, inshallah, next week we will talk about the Independence Act, the princely states of India, and the death of Jinnah and the birth of a nation called Pakistan. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Marcus Sahaba, the voice of Ahl Sunnah wal Jamaah.